OK. So I want to claim that three-dimensional Young-Mills theory is interesting in its own right for a number of different reasons. We can say that two-dimensional Young-Mills theory is pretty much completely understood. There are no propagating degrees of freedom. It is exactly solvable. But of course, it is something of a trivial theory.
Yeah. Or even pure glue.
Pure glue. Right. Of course, the four-dimensional theory, which is what we would all like to understand in more detail, is far too difficult to deal with. The three-dimensional theory, in between, has propagating degrees of freedom, so it is a non-trivial field theory. Nevertheless, there are some nice features for it. It has a dimensional coupling. It's a super-renormalizable theory. Therefore, one might expect that it is just the right mixture of non-triviality and solvability in some ways, or at least one hopes so. Therefore, this would be an interesting case to study in some detail. The other reason why three-dimensional theory would be interesting is that there is indeed a real physical context in which you can apply the results of this theory. And that has to do with high temperature QCD. We take QCD at high temperatures, go into the deconfinement phase, and we have a plasma of quarks and gluons. And if you go to very high temperatures, it's easy to see that there is some sort of a dimensional reduction, at least for certain quantities. For example, the gauge potential, if you expand in terms of the Matsubara frequencies in an imaginary time formulation, then the you can look at the propagator. It goes like k squared. This is a three-dimensional momentum plus the square of the Matsubara frequency. So from this point of view, that's like a mass term. And therefore, at high temperature, pretty much all these modes become massive of order temperature and disappear, except for n equal to 0, which is the important surviving mode at high temperature. And that reduces to, effectively, because you're looking at n equal to 0, a three-dimensional Young-Mills theory. This is, of course, well known. And this actually tells us that there is this context in which results from three-dimensional Young-Mills can indeed be applied. And not only is that something we can do, but it's also something we must do, because there are serious infrared divergences if you do perturbation theory at finite temperature. There are two types of divergences. The first one has to do with the fact that, as in any plasma, there must be screening of interactions. The electrostatic type screening is very similar to the Debye screening that we know in an abelian plasma. Of course, the details are much more involved. One has to still sum up an infinite series of diagrams. That goes by the name of hard thermal loops and so on. And that part is pretty much completely understood by now. At least we know what those terms look like. We know how to sum them. We know how to incorporate them in diagrammatic perturbation theory and carry out perturbations at finite temperature. However, there is another class of infrared divergences which are not addressed by the electrostatic type screening. These are the magnetic type divergences, and you see them in a number of different quantities that you calculate at finite temperature. If you take, for example, gauge boson propagation to two loops, if you do perturbative expansions for thermodynamic quantities like pressure and so on, they start showing up at various orders. The diagrammatic perturbation theory is divergent, has to do with the fact that the magnetic type interactions are not screened. And you need that to be screened to be able to set up a consistent theory. This was, of course, pointed out many years ago by Gross, Pisarsky, and Yaffe and Linde, and who also argued that in the dimensional reduction that I talked about a moment ago, the three-dimensional Young-Mills that emerges will have a mass gap, and it is this mass gap that's going to cure these divergences. And therefore, the mass gap of these 3D Young-Mills is a parameter that directly comes up in the quark-gluon plasma, and therefore, hopefully, something that we can actually measure experimentally someday. So ultimately, all this reasoning is related to the question, even in four-dimensional QCD, can we define thermal perturbation theory? If you want to do it, the three-dimensional problem has to be solved. So these are two reasons why I think the three-dimensional theory is interesting to study as a theory in its own right, and that's what I want to talk about. What I would like to talk about is a particular approach which we have been pursuing for some years now. It's a Hamiltonian analysis, and this is most of what I'm going to talk about. For the rest of the talk is joint work with Dimitra Karabli, who is here, and Chanju Kim, who is not here. What do we do? Well, Hamiltonian analysis in field theories is very seldom done these days, but it is not terribly difficult to do. And I just want to go over the key steps that are involved in setting up such an approach. It's a Yang-Mills theory. Therefore, in a Hamiltonian picture, it's easiest to choose A naught equal to zero as a gauge condition. And since we are in two dimensions, 2 plus 1, once A naught disappears, we have two components of gauge fields, AI, I equals 1, 2. They undergo gauge transformations like this. And the key observation is that the wave functions must be gauge invariant. That is the imposition of the Gauss law, if you like. And that, in fact, is the most difficult part. That's what makes this whole theory very, very difficult. Okay, so this is what we need to address. Let me remind you, there are three basic steps that is involved in the process. It's a Hamiltonian analysis, therefore we will need an inner product to define the scalar products of wave functions. The catch here is that we have to integrate over gauge potentials, modulo gauge transformations, therefore that inner product has to be understood on this gauge invariant space. We have to then set up a Hamiltonian operator, and eventually, of course, as in any theory, we have to solve the Schrödinger equation. So these are the three steps that I want to go through. Of course, a lot of this is technical. We are trying to solve a Yang-Mills theory, so much of what follows will be somewhat technical, and I'm going to just walk through that with you. But before that, perhaps it's proper for me to summarize what we actually are going to get before we get into the details. Okay. So I want to tell you what the results are, sort of give away the punchline, so to speak. And here is what we are going to do. I want to introduce a set of matrix variables to parameterize the gauge fields in the problem. Okay. These variables will turn out to be extremely convenient for us. It's much like saying that, you know, if you want to solve a hydrogen atom, the natural thing is to go to the spherical coordinate system, although in principle, it can be solved in any other coordinate system, right? These matrix variables, in some ways, are sort of the nicest variables to bring out that solvability aspect of the theory. The advantage of this parameterization in terms of matrices is that the gauge transformations act in a simple way, rather than as an inhomogeneous transformation of the potentials. It's simply a left multiplication by the transformation matrix. That makes it very easy to implement gauge invariants. We take a matrix combination, M dagger times M, G will cancel out in the middle, and this Hermitian matrix will be gauge invariant, so we can formulate everything in terms of that. So that'll be the first step that I will go through. The second step is, having taken these as the way to parameterize the fields, we will calculate the volume of the gauge invariant configurations, and that can be done exactly. Okay. The volume measure that is needed for integration over gauge invariant field configurations will turn out to be given by the Wiesemann-Witten action for this matrix H. There is another Haar measure for H that I'll talk about. This coefficient in front is the adjoint Casimir of the group. That is n for SUN, but it is 0 for an abelian theory, and that exponential factor will therefore make all the difference between the abelian and the non-abelian theories. Yes?
Excuse me, I don't want to get lost in the first experiment.
there are two A fields, right?
Yeah. This is just a, this is one of them, complex component. Z is.
You'll have two different matrices for each of these that you would get.
Well, no, M and adjoint of M. The other one will be the adjoint of M.
If M was unitary, it'd be trivial gauge.
Right. M is a complex matrix. So M dagger.
I wasn't worried about that. I mean, there's AI, there's X and Y components of A.
Right. I'm going to show you in the next transparency. It's A, I will combine them into complex components, AZ and AZ bar.
Oh, okay. Oh, and I see.
That's a Z. This is a Z. Sorry.
Okay.
That's not two. Sorry. Yeah. At this point already, since we know something about the configuration space and how the volume looks like in this space, one can actually produce some sort of an intuitive argument why there should be a gap in the theory. So I will go through that because I think it's kind of a neat argument. It's a bit of a hand-waving argument, but nevertheless, I think it captures the essential physics. So I want to go over that a little bit. Then I'm going to, well, one shouldn't be surprised to see conformal field theory at this point because, after all, this is a Wiseman and Witten action. And therefore, we can use some ideas from conformal field theory to identify sort of the simplest or the correct variables for the theory. Okay. It will turn out, actually, that you can do better than this matrix H that I introduced here. We can actually talk about the current associated with this Wiseman and Witten theory, and that in fact will suffice to give all the results that we need. Okay, so I will go over that argument. So this is all having to do with the issue of setting up the inner product, and the second step would be to write down the Hamiltonian. The essence of this argument is that since we only need this current, I can rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of the current. And that I'm going to do here. I will go over that also in some detail. But the key observation here is when all is said and done, you notice that there is a term like J delta by delta J. It's a functional differential operator, of course. But this simply counts the number of powers of J. And that has a prefactor M, which is a constant related to E square. And therefore, it shows that there is a minimum energy that is contributed from this term anytime you have a power of J. And that is effectively the essence of where the mass gap would come from. Okay. So this is actually a very crucial calculation. And the computation of this term is also related to the measure computation as well. Yeah, I'm going to tell you about the regularization. But before I, since there'll be a few transparencies down, let me just make a statement that everything I say has been checked with regulators. Okay. So when I write these somewhat schematic-looking expressions like the Hamiltonian, there is a precisely regulated form of that, actually. Okay. So everything has been checked with regulators. What do we do next? Once we got the Hamiltonian, we will look at the Schrödinger equation. We will concentrate on the vacuum state because that, after all, is the most important state and also the easiest to solve for. So we'll find the vacuum wave function. It'll, of course, be a wave functional. And once we have obtained that wave function, we can actually go and ask what is the expectation value of the Wilson line. So I'll take the Wilson line for the theory, the Wilson loop in the fundamental representation, compute its expectation value, and we will get an area law like this. Okay. And not only we will get an area law, we will get a calculable value for the prefactor here, sorry, this coefficient of the area here, which is what is called the string tension. And that formula will be simply this. Okay. So this gives you an analytic derivation of the string tension, and at which point, of course, we have finally, a number that we can compare with lattice analysis. I will take the data from Michael Tepper, which was quoted in Igor's talk 2 days ago. The string tension that we calculate agrees with Tepper with a discrepancy less than 3% or so. Okay.
It's significant that when n equal to 1, there's no string
tension. N equal to 1 would be a trivial theory. Yeah, there will be no string tension.
And so that's all fine,
this is all finite n. Although maybe if you look at this, you see immediately that this is indeed consistent with large n. Because at large n,
you get
e square n, the truth coupling coming out, actually. So what all the things we do are at finite n, but all the results we find are actually consistent with large n expectations.
So this also shows that for large n, there's no correct.
There is a 1 over n square root. Yes, there is a square root correction. Finally, then I will get back to the issue of the magnetic mass. From what we have done, we can get a number for the magnetic mass. I will compare that with experiments as well. I'm sorry, lattice as well.
Not the magnetic mass is no large n correction.
I'm sorry?
The magnetic mass is just e squared n, so there's no correction.
That's right. This is just e squared n.
1 over n squared.
That's right, yeah. But of course, when I say this is a magnetic mass, you have to understand this is a mass cap parameter from the 3D angles. To relate it to the 4D magnetic mass, it is only in the strictly in the very high temperature limit. So there are, in an actual calculation, there will be temperature dependent further corrections to this. I will talk a little bit about glue balls after that, and also look, if time allows, at Yang-Mills plus Chern-Simons, which is a bit of an interesting case because in the Chern-Simons theory, we don't expect an area law, we expect screening. So you might ask, how is that going to come out from this kind of analysis, just to, as a nice case to test this out. Okay. So that is basically the summary of what I'll do. And now I'm going to go over this in step by step. Okay. So I don't know if I... Okay, so I'll start going over it. And okay. So let's talk about the matrix parameterization. We are in two dimensions. Time has been taken out. It's a Hamiltonian description. Therefore, we have two space coordinates, x1 and x2. Combine them into z and z bar like this. Take the gauge potentials, combine them into az and az bar like that. Okay. So once we have done that, first statement is we can parameterize this gauge potential A in this fashion. The holomorphic derivative of a matrix M and then M inverse. And A bar would be simply the Hermitian conjugate of this expression here. The matrix M is in general not unitary. If the gauge group is SUN, the matrix M should be an SLNC matrix, which is, if you like, the complexification of SUN. And more generally, if you do it for other Lie groups, you end up with complexification of the Lie group. That's what happens. So this is a parameterization I'm going to use. And now we can ask, why is this possible? Why is this parameterization possible? This actually is well known in the context of 2D Yang-Mills theory and has been used. But let me just give you a quick and dirty argument why such a parameterization would be possible. The first observation is that if I take the holomorphic derivative, act on z bar and w bar here like this, that is effectively the delta function. Put another way, this is the chiral Dirac operator, Euclidean chiral Dirac operator. This is its Green's function, the propagator in coordinate space. So d has an inverse in this fashion. Okay. Also related to Liouville's theorem in ordinary complex variable analysis. As a result, we set up this equation. If you give me a potential A, I will set up this equation where the script A bar, is defined by this equation. Okay. Claim this can be solved at least as a perturbation series because dz is invertible. So imagine I have found A and the script A bar. Then I construct a matrix by taking the path ordered exponential like that. Generally speaking, such a construction would be path dependent, but precisely because the quote unquote the associated field strength like object here is zero, this is independent of the path and we get a function m. By construction, A is then minus dm m inverse. So this is the essential argument, and there are several levels of sophistication you can apply to this. You'll find that this is discussed in great detail, for example. Well, in some detail in the famous Atiyah Bhatt paper of 1982, where they show how this can all be generalized to all Riemann surfaces and all kinds of stuff like that. Okay. We won't need much of that, but this is the basic idea of the parameterization. I want to point out in this case that there is a slight caveat to what I said, namely that if you give me a matrix M and you take the matrix multiplied by something purely anti-holomorphic on the right, they give you the same potential, because after all, the holomorphic derivative will kill this. Now, if you are strictly speaking on the sphere, you don't need that because there are no globally defined anti-holomorphic functions that you can write. Nevertheless, we will need some of this freedom because our gauge potentials are, after all, not globally defined to begin with. They're only defined up to gauge transformations. So some of this freedom will come back and will be important in getting us confinement in the theory. Okay. Let me put that away for the moment. And then, as I said, gauge transformations are easy because if I do a gauge transformation from the previous formula for A, it's rather obvious that if I simply look at this formula, that gauge transformation of A is simply corresponding to left multiplication of this matrix by the gauge transformation matrix. It gives you this transformation for the potential. And this is indeed the big simplification. Therefore, the matrix M diagram is gauge invariant. Okay. So that's the first step that I was saying. Let's calculate the volume element. To compute the volume element, I take the gauge potentials parameterized in terms of the matrices. I do a small variation, just algebraically, we work it out. It is the covariant derivative of this variation delta M, M inverse. Now, to define the volume element, I need a metric. And the metric for the Yang-Mills theory is given to us from the action. It is the starting metric is simply delta A, delta A bar, okay, integrated over two dimensions. So I start with this metric, which is defined on the space of potentials, on gauge potentials. Just substitute this parameterization here, and we'll find this result. Notice that there is a dd bar in the middle, but if you look at the remaining two pieces here, and look at the metric defined just by those two, that is precisely the standard Cartan metric in excellence. Okay. So therefore, by working through this, we see immediately how to write the volume element. The volume element first in terms of A would have a Jacobian coming from here. And then, of course, the volume element associated with the group volume associated with the excellence. So we can factor this into two pieces. And here is what it looks like, what I just told you a moment ago. The volume element has a determinant that's part of the Jacobian. This will be the Haar measure for excellence. The next step, M is a complex matrix. I can factor it into a Hermitian part, a unitary part, the polar decomposition of a matrix. The unitary part we know is what is removable by gauge transformation because we know that gauge transformations acted on the left of M. And rho, the Hermitian part, must be the gauge invariant part. Well, we don't have to do much work here. We simply substitute into this variation, and it factors like this. How do I figure out this Haar measure volume? Just take lots of wedge products and symmetrize to the maximal dimension you can get, just as we do volume element on any space. We do that just algebraically. This factors into Haar measure for SUN, and something that is left over, which is precisely the Cartan killing on SLNC mod SUN. Okay. Now, this factorization is no surprise because, after all, we know that SLNC, other than the SUN, the rest of it is a contractible space. So there is no surprise in this exact factorization of this volume element. Okay. So this factorization can be done exactly. All I have to do now is to put these things together. Of course, I have given explicitly in some parameterization how to construct d mu of h. We won't need that formula for most of what we need to do. this is simply the Haar measure for this coset. If you keep that in mind, that's all we need, pretty much. Okay. So what happens when I put it all into the measure? The volume for gauge potentials is this determinant times the d mu of this h times d mu of u. What I am asked to do is not the volume on potentials, but potentials modulo gauge transformations. Very easy then to write it down. I get this formula here, factoring out the gauge transformations, and the entire calculation then reduces to the computation of this two-dimensional determinant. This determinant, of course, is well known. It is calculated by the so-called Polyakov-Weigman formula, and you can work out the expression I'll show you in a moment. It gives you the Wessel-Minow Witten action. And the prefactor here is the Casimir of the adjoint representation. So this calculation is an anomaly calculation in two dimensions. Therefore, of course, a regulator is needed in doing all this calculation, but it's very robust, it's an anomaly calculation, and the answer will be given by this formula, I mean, no matter how we do it, actually. Okay? So that gives you an exact computation of the measure or the volume element of gauge invariant configurations. Now,
and what's amazing is that it's local.
Yes, it is. It has to do with the fact that you see that the matrix M is in some sense a Wilson line, but because it is purely holomorphically defined on the curves, becomes a function that makes it local. Actually, that's a key step. Actually, let me show you. One more thing, this is just a display of the Wessel-Minow Witten action. I won't need any explicit formula for this in any of what follows, but just for completeness, I display this. But the end result of all this argument is that now that we got the measure, we can write down the inner product for two wave functions. By Gauss' law, wave functions only depend on h. They have to be gauge invariant. And integration measure is this, so here is the inner product that we need. Okay, so this is the inner product for wave functions. Two remarks I want to make in this connection. First remark is that as in 3 plus 1 Yang-Mills, 2 plus 1 Yang-Mills has a Grybov ambiguity if you try to fix the gauge. Okay. That's a simple topological argument can be given for that. Nevertheless, we can show that this computation of the measure does not have any difficulty due to Grybov problem. It's a rather technical argument, and if anyone wants to see that, I'll be very happy to discuss it after the seminar. Okay. The second statement is that this shows, imagine we are calculating some matrix element in this theory. Ultimately, we are going to compute the average of some quantity here with this measure. Therefore, effectively, matrix elements in the theory reduced to correlators of a Hermitian Wessel-Minow Witten theory. Okay. So that is the implication of having, I'm sorry?
Equal time.
Yeah. If it's not equal time, I have to put e to the minus iht factors and then reduce it this way. Yeah. Why am I saying that? Because the point is that because it is a Wessel-Minow Witten type theory, it's some sort of a conformal field theory. Therefore, we can actually make some statements, some more statements about the kind of states we need to consider. But of course, this is not the usual unitary type Wessel-Minow Witten theory. Therefore, I want to go over the discussion of how we treat Hermitian Wessel-Minow Witten theories. This is about Hermitian Wessel-Minow Witten theory. What we do is to set up a comparison. The Hermitian model is discussed by comparing it to a particular comparison model which is unitary. And this way, a certain dictionary can be set up by which properties of the Hermitian model can be easily extracted. What do we do? take level k plus 2ca Hermitian model. The comparison model for that is the level k unitary model. Okay, so this is an SUN theory. This is SLN mod SUN. Why are the level numbers related so? What happens is that if I start with this level k Wiseman-Witten theory, we know that there is the parameter kappa, which is the k plus the ca, which is the dual Coxeter number and all. It is this quantity which is relevant for the computation of the correlation functions. For example, it is kappa which appears in the Knishnik summology of equations, which will determine the correlators of the theory. In the Hermitian model, this renormalization happens in a little different way. K plus 2ca, strictly speaking, this is like a negative number here because it's buried in SIH, you don't see that. But the resulting kappa is minus of K plus ca. Okay. So what happens is that the two models are related by replacing the parameter kappa by minus kappa. And this can be used to obtain information about correlation functions of the Hermitian model. In particular, if I take the unitary model, there are the so-called integrable representations. Roughly speaking, the highest, the spin has to be less than or equal to the level number k. And what is wrong with non-integrable representations is that if you exceed this bound, go to non-integrable ones, then the correlation functions are zero. Okay? This is the existence of the null vector in the algebra and all that kind of stuff. What happens on the other side, though, because we change the sign of the kappa, is that anything that is non-integrable has correlation function equal to infinity. Okay. This is not a space-time singularity, it's a singularity in the coupling constant. If you look at the actual correlators, for example, the four-point function involves hypergeometric functions and so on. These are really, you're hitting the poles of the gamma functions there and so on. Okay. So this is really, things blow up. What does that mean in our context? We were trying to set up an inner product using the Hermitian model. Therefore, if something becomes infinite, that means we do not have finite norm. So for states of so-called finite norm, which is finite norm within quotes, means as finite as you can get in a field theory, there are certain regulators that have to be put in. But if you want states of finite norm, then you have to confine yourself to integrable representations. But on top of that, this is for k plus 2ca as the level number. We don't have that, we simply have 2ca. Therefore, k is equal to 0 for us. Therefore, there are no integrable representations except the identity. Okay. Therefore, everything has to be derived from the secondaries, so to speak, by the application of the current. Therefore, for this theory, all the states of finite norm must be functions of the current. So we can do better than simply saying that the wave function is a function of H. It is even more specific, it's a function of the current that we need. Now, we can also go another way, which is to simply look at the Wilson line. We have the A and the A bar. We substitute, simply use trace identities, you find that it depends on this current J. So we find something interesting, namely, if all gauge invariant operators are derivable from the Wilson line, then this shows that the current suffices to give us that information. Mm-hmm. The other argument tells you that you can't do anything more than that anyway, because you're going to run into infinite now. Okay, so the current is just what you need, it's necessary and sufficient. Is that? Yes. J is this, is this comp. Yeah.
There's also J bar.
Right. What happens is, maybe I can say it here. My A is like this, and the A bar is this one. But these I can write as J and I think I have to get this right. Simply by algebraic, because there is J has the D of M dagger M. We work this out, cancels out here. Sorry, this is minus, so this should be minus. No, this is right. So what does this mean? This means that if I can make a complex gauge transformation, then this AA bar is complex gauge equivalent to J0.
J is gauge invariant?
J is gauge invariant.
Right, normally you can't write the Wilson line.
That's right.
Or the local gauge invariant, because the point is this really isn't a local gauge invariant.
This is not local.
Okay.
Yeah.
So A and A bar.
Yep. So if I look at this formula, it looks as if I have done a gauge transformation of J with the matrix M dagger. And here, of course, gauge transformation of 0 with the matrix M dagger. So if I can use M dagger, which is complex, then AA bar is equivalent to JN0. But for the Wilson line, it doesn't matter whether it's complex or real. It cancels out in the trace. Therefore, the Wilson line simply depends on J. That's how it works. Right?
Is Jared Wolfenthal's operator sensitive enough to compute with itself a space-like separation, right?
Yeah.
It will or won't?
It will.
J's commutative space-like separation.
Yes, because
so you really recast gauge theory as a local field theory. As a field theory of local gauge.
Yes, the transformation from A to J is highly non-local.
I know, but in the end of the day, you have something
that's
which
right.
internally is local.
That's correct.
That's very surprising. Mm-hmm. That's really remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is also the Wesselmina term later.
I think that's where all the...
I don't know.
The Wesselmina term is not really a problem because, first of all, it's a Hermitian matrix, so there is no topology. Even though I write the Wesselmina term, in principle, I can integrate it and write in two dimensions.
Does this go back to the whole dream of Sugawara, Sommerfeld, these people writing the stress and things?
I'm not so sure because I have to caution, this current is still at equal time. We haven't put in the time evolution yet.
But everything is a straight picture.
Right, that's right.
But will J and J dot commute to find a separation?
No.
Okay.
No, they won't.
Okay.
That's right. So that is the essential result. I'm going to now take the wave function to be given in terms of this current, and give the Hamiltonian. But before I do that, let me pause for a moment to just show you. This is rather well known, but let me just show you how the Wesselmina-Witten action arises. The reason is I will need this one transparency later. How do we do the determinant of dd bar? We write it as trace log dd bar, take a variation, say, with respect to a bar. Just algebraically, it involves the inverse of d bar at coincident points. We need regulators there. If you like, this is like a current in the theory. We regulate it. It comes out to be this quantity here. And then you reintegrate. That's what you do. Okay. So the key step is regularized computation of this current, which gives you this formula. Okay. That is what is involved, and we will find exactly the same thing appearing in the Hamiltonian in a second. Now, let me now go to the intuitive argument I promised you. I think I have to. So far, we have only understood the configuration space and the volume measure on that space. We haven't really talked about the dynamics, but we can start to see how this can lead to some sort of a gap. And the idea is the following. Let's look briefly at the Hamiltonian. There is an E squared term. There is a B squared term. That's what the Hamiltonian will look like. And we know that since B goes like the curl of A, roughly speaking, E with B will go like the momentum P. Okay, so let me just take that case, ignore the nonlinear term here for a second. This of course means that by the uncertainty principle, delta A, delta B should go like the momentum P. So we estimate the energy by substituting from here, and we get this result. Of course, delta B is still arbitrary, so we do the standard thing, minimize the Hamiltonian with respect to that. Delta B square will go like K from, I'm sorry, I messed up K and P. K is the same as P. So, okay. So the fluctuation in B square will go like P. We put that back into the energy, you get energy going like the momentum. That, of course, is the standard argument why we get the photon in electrodynamics. Okay, the energy going like the momentum. Or, I mean, you have also seen this harmonic oscillator, that kind of stuff, right? But let's look at what happens in our case. We are evaluating expectation value of the Hamiltonian. There's something more to it than just putting uncertainty principle values and minimizing. We should take this result and ask, what is the most probable value of delta B square, not just minimize it. That is controlled by the measure in evaluating the expectation value. The resume of it in action, if I write it in terms of the magnetic field, starts off in this fashion. Okay. It's quadratic in B, B 1 over P square B. So when I exponentiate it, I'm going to get a Gaussian in B with a width that goes like P square. And therefore, as P becomes small, that becomes narrower and narrower, and that determines the fluctuation, not the minimization argument that we said before. If I take this value of the fluctuation given by this Gaussian and put that back into energy, I find there will be some constant left over. And that will be like the gap that I'm going to find. Okay. So it is the fact that the measure cuts off the infrared part of the modes rather sharply, that's what gives you the gap in the theory. So the structure of the configuration space already contains that information in a sense. Let me now go to the Hamiltonian. Let's write this out in detail. Looks a little cluttered, but the steps are not too difficult. Well, first thing, B square. We can substitute for the gauge potential in terms of M, M dagger, and so on. Simplify this. No surprise, it's just D bar J, D bar J. Okay. There is the normal ordering that's involved. I'll come to that in a second. Okay. So that is the B square term. Its gauge invariant can be written in terms of J. Some prefactors here. What about the kinetic term coming from the E square, which goes like delta by delta A, and so on? We act on the wave function. Now, the wave function is a function of the current J from all the previous arguments. Therefore, I can go via chain rule and calculate it. What am I going to find? I'll first differentiate with respect to J, and then J with respect to A and A bar. So I'll get a term like that. But I'll also get a term like this when the second differentiation acts on what the factor obtained from the first differentiation. I'll get a term like that. So there are two terms involved, one involving two derivatives with respect to the current, one involving a single derivative. We have to calculate this, and this is rather delicate because it has coincident points. You have to compute with regulators and so on. We do that calculation. Let me call it little omega, and this is big omega for the moment. We do that calculation, and not surprisingly, this calculation is exactly the computation of this factor that we needed for the measure. It's exactly the same calculation. And for the same reason, therefore, we will get an answer for this which is given by the two-dimensional anomaly. And once I put that back in and simplify the terms a bit, I find that this omega goes like a factor m, which is the coupling constant E square, adjoint Casimir is a 2 pi times the current J itself. Okay. So that is a key step, because this tells us that there is a term which is first order in the differentiation like this. The second term also can be calculated, it looks like this, which you will also recognize. It is part of the operator product expansion for current. So it's also something that is very natural in the theory, and that is what comes for the second derivative term. Okay. So this is the main result, and you can ask, why do I really get this term, and why was it that the computation was exactly the same as in the computation of the measure? It's not surprising, because we can show that this term, and if you look, check the self-adjointness, we are doing the self-adjointness of this with the measure containing that Wiesel-Minowitan term. Therefore, you need exactly this term to make this self-adjoint. Okay. So there is a correlation between the existence of this term, the factor in the measure, and self-adjointness, and that gives you a cross-check. And that also explains why this calculation was exactly the same as the measure calculation. Okay. So everything ties in together now, and one can actually check that this is indeed the correct Hamiltonian. Let me now make a statement about regularization. Of course, one of the issues here throughout everything I said is the issue of regulators. So what we have done is to fix one set of regulators in the beginning, because it took some trial and error to find a good regulator that would work, and do all the calculations with exactly the same regulators, because we also did not want to have to deal with possibility of conflict of regulators and hidden anomalies that we would not be aware of. So everything was done with a single regulator. And the idea here is the following. The regularization all has to do with regulating, if you like, Green's functions like this, or if you like, these inverse x minus y type powers. And this gives you a regulated form of that. We put a Gaussian type regulator, and this and its conjugate, this is G bar, and its conjugate will regulate everything that we talk about in the theory. Okay, so for example, when you find D bar inverse, like in here, like in this equation, that is going to be a Green's function, which ultimately is related to this. Okay. This would be the regulated version would be put there and calculated. And the H's are there because it has to do with that holomorphicity, that holomorphic ambiguity that I mentioned earlier. And what happens is we want to keep everything holomorphically invariant under the transmission. Let me put it differently. See, what we found was I could write A like this, but M and M multiplied by something anti-holomorphic would give the same A. So you might say that while we managed to get rid of gauge invariance, the price we pay is that we have to ensure that there is invariance for everything under this transmission. Therefore, when we regulate our Green's functions, we have to ensure that it's done consistent with that. So what we have done here, if you look at this, the y bar argument is the same, the holomorphic argument has been shifted, and this is to ensure that the Green's function transforms exactly in the correct way under this transformation. Okay. So that is the reason why we need this factor. H is so this goes to some holomorphic function. Like that. And therefore the current that I talked about, maybe it's nicer to write transformation of the current, and I have something like this, which is my current. This transforms like that. So it transforms like a connection under gauge transformations, under holomorphic transformations. Okay. So we want to ensure that this is preserved. And if you like, this is like a, it's like the path of the exponential I need to ensure invariance under this kind of transformation. I mean, I can discuss it more with you if you like. I will come back to this point a little later also. Okay. So this is necessary to preserve that, to make sure that we do not have anything ambiguous under this change in all our formulae. Now let me look at the Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation for the vacuum state is easy. This is all we need to solve. Of course, if I ignore the B squared term, the potential energy, then it's easy to solve because the kinetic term had delta by delta.
One second. When you do the regulation,
yeah.
Regulators, you have to introduce counter terms for something.
No, we don't need to introduce counter terms. We need to regulate everything to ensure that all the operator products are well defined. But there are no infinities that we need to remove at the end. So there is no renormalization to be done, which I guess is what you would expect, right? Because it's a super renormalizable theory. And we are talking gauge invariant quantities, so wave function renormalization and so on. That ambiguity shouldn't turn up either. But I mean, just to be on the safe side, we regulate everything to make sure that everything works out right. Shall I go? Okay. So if I ignore the potential energy for a moment, the kinetic term had derivatives, two functional derivatives, delta by delta j, and then square of that, and so on. Therefore, psi naught equal to 1 is a perfectly well-defined vacuum state for the theory. It's a bit of a trivial state. But you see, we have one advantage over that trivial observation, namely, this is normalizable in a sense, because the measure has this factor. The normalization integral of this is exactly the partition function of the Wiesmann-Witten theory. So in that sense, we can actually give it a finite norm. And therefore, unlike taking that as a solution in, say, 3 plus 1, here you can actually take that as a sensible starting point, if you like. And in principle, you can do perturbation theory in V. We don't have to do that. What we do is, okay, I have displayed the potential energy also here by putting in factors regulating. The potential energy requires a normal ordering, so I have to subtract this. Okay. Here we go. Yeah. So normal ordering with respect to, I have to define what I mean by the vacuum in the theory, and I normal order such that I can solve the Schrödinger equation with exactly zero on the right side. Okay. So any constant that I obtained by applying the Hamiltonian on the wave functions, if you put an arbitrary constant here, then I can match this constant so that this gives me exactly zero. That's what I do. No.
But the energy seems to have a closed form. The vacuum energy is a closed form.
For this case. This is not surprising. Why? Because.
It's one of our epsilons, right?
Yes, it's one of our epsilons. There's no finite piece here. Yeah. The point is, you see, the kinetic term. We had a term that looked like the operator product of two currents, if you recall. And that means when I have two currents like this, and I take the expectation values, I will end up getting some sort of operator product here, and there is a C number that you have to subtract. That's the same kind of thing that we find, for example, in the Sugawara type construction and so on. It's exactly the same term that comes here. It's just written in our regulator, so it looks 1 over epsilon squared. So I have to subtract that to define in this in such a way that the expectation value of this V is actually zero in the vacuum. That's the principle.
But the Hamiltonian
vacuum, right?
Not yet. So I have put in the number that I would get. I mean, I have anticipated the result here, if you like. That's what I have done.
This may be the result for an exact eigenstate of the sum of time.
Right.
So you're saying that you can find an exact eigenstate?
In some sense. I'll tell you exactly what I mean one transparency later. Okay. What we do is we take this expression for the potential energy and the kinetic energy, we solve for psi naught. Psi naught works out to be a series in the current J. And we can calculate to arbitrary number of J's we want. I won't do that.
That's the same as a V expansion.
That is related to a V expansion, but it's more like a summed up V expansion. Actually, let me show you that, then I think it...
The Hamiltonian was classically semi-positive definite?
Yeah, yeah.
And quantum mechanically, the way you regulate it, it remains semi-positive definite?
I think so,
so you
yeah.
have a zero, a state of zero energy without fermion oscillators to cancel?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, is this subtracted?
I'm subtracting of this...
The Hamiltonian is not positive.
No, but I have subtracted a zero-point energy. It's not positive in that sense, yeah. That's right. After subtracting the zero, yes. Okay, so let me go ahead with the construction of the vacuum state. The key observation here is that this formula for the potential energy, if I take the kinetic energy as a differential operator, functional differential operator, act on this, this is in fact an eigenstate of the kinetic energy. And this is the key result, actually. And the eigenvalue is two times the mass parameter. Okay. That makes it possible for us to actually solve for the wave function. So we can actually take as our wave function, as an answer, if you like, it is exponential of some functional, which depends on currents. There is a term with two currents and some kernel to be determined. A term with three currents and some kernel to be determined, four currents and so on, and substitute and actually determine all the kernels.
Is there a formal series solution for any energy, right? But is there a normalization condition that determines the actual energy, normalizability? Isn't that right? Is there going to be a formal series solution for any continuous value of the energy?
What do you mean? Then I'm going to set the energy to zero, right?
Right, but you could have said, say you could have set it to two and still gotten a solution.
Sure, that's right.
So how do you make found the right solution? Only one of these is normalizable.
Yeah. Well, this is certainly normalizable.
This state is normalizable.
This state is normalizable. Okay. That we can check.
So this is a state that satisfies that H psi not equals zero.
Yeah. Yeah. And let me just show you that state actually. Here is how it looks. It has this 2J term. This is the kernel that we need to satisfy the Schrodinger equation. There is a 3J term with a kernel which is quite complicated, but it can be worked out. And there is a term with 4Js and so on we can work.
So how do you know it's normalizable if it's a whole infinite series?
We don't quite know that, actually. But we know that the contribution, you see, this has a Gaussian, this gives you a Gaussian piece. If I take the mean square fluctuation of the currents given by this, then we can show that the contribution of these terms are small, at least at high momentum modes and low momentum modes.
Look for a solution that didn't have zero energy, but some any real number.
Yes.
Isn't it true you'd also obtain a series solution like this?
Solving H equals Z.
Yeah. Because you just, the structure of Hamiltonian just gives you a power series, right?
That's right. Just a second, let me think of that. That would be simply determining that zero point energy in a different way. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no.
How many
eigenstates
are in the mass gap?
Right. I guess
the question of how do you know there's a mass gap if there actually are states of this form for any E arbitrarily close to zero?
Well, this state involves, I mean, the operator here, I have a certain normal ordering on these operators. If I fix that to be what is given in the previous one, there is only one eigenstate, just this one.
Sorry,
okay, I cannot change that energy.
Yeah.
What happens is that if I look at the kinetic term has a term that looks like this, with some omega plus other pieces. If I take this, this is going to take two currents, replace it by its operator part expansion. If I look at the potential energy, which is two currents, and I act with this operator on this, I'll get a C number contribution. That is precisely the term I subtract. If I keep that as my subtraction term, there is only one state that you can get. So with that definition of normal ordering, there is one state. That is the statement.
What happened to the linear term in J in the kinetic energy?
There is a linear term also.
Yeah. Now, then how is V an eigenfunction of T? Oh, I see, because when you annihilate J, you put back the J.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, can you say a few more words about why that's a surprising fact? You said it has to do with Yang-Mills theory, it's very special. And what, I mean, you certainly don't have that in the context of quantum mechanics. You normally don't apply the kinetic energy operator to the potential energy.
No, you see,
the fact that in Yang-Mills, the kinetic and potential energy are intertwined in some way.
Well, what I'm saying is the following. You see, suppose we wanted to look at, let's say we started with psi naught equal to 1, okay, which is the kinetic, the eigenstate or the kinetic energy with zero energy. Now we want to perturb in a series in the potential energy. When I start perturbing, I will encounter at some point the action of the kinetic operator on the potential energy coming from commutators and so on. Okay. If I do that, that will bring me back to this question of whether this is an eigenstate. In general, it doesn't have to be, and then I cannot solve. If, because I have this particular relation, it turns out that I can actually sum up the series there. And that also would explain the question of the unique state. The one that is uniquely connected to this as the eigenstate of the kinetic energy is this state. Okay, so if you start with psi naught equal to 1 as the eigenstate just for the kinetic term, and perturb, this is the only unique state connected to that.
Well, that's because you started with the state that has zero energy.
I agree.
But what about glue balls?
I will come to glue balls, actually.
So those will be other states.
Other states, which I have to ensure, I have to make sure that they are orthogonal to this, and then work out their energies. I will come to that.
You can't have a term linear.
Linear in J would be ruled out by the fact that we don't have that holomorphicity condition. In fact, that is crucial, and that will tell us that we need to have only singlets because of that reason. Okay, that is where the confinement is buried. Okay.
That's a very strange looking function. There's no problem at k equals 0.
No, there's no problem in k equals 0. There's no problem at high k. And as I said, if I take the RMS value for the fluctuations in J control given by the Gaussian part, then this contribution is very small at high momentum and at low momentum. High momentum is just standard perturbation theory. At low momentum is more surprising, but can be understood from the fact that you could think of this as a perturbation around psi naught equal to 1 using the potential energy. Okay. So if you like, it is constructed as a 1 over E square expansion around the potential energy. So in that sense, this is small there also. Further,
why can't you have terms of
3J? 3Js is what I have. You can have 4Js and so on. Can have a linear term. 3J I can contract with the F symbol, and it is possible to get.
It's roughly speaking like 2 gluon, 3 gluon, 4 gluon.
In some sense, yeah. In some sense, that is what's happening. Let me also point out another feature, which is that if I go to very high momentum limit, this wave function becomes this one, which is a standard perturbative wave function that is well known. If I go to the low momentum limit, then effectively it becomes this object. That, of course, is like a two-dimensional Yang-Mills action. Now that means I can calculate a number of things at low energy using this action, I mean this wave function. Okay. So what we do is, here is a repetition of the statement I made earlier, that the higher terms are smaller at the two limits that we had. The modes of B correspond to low momentum. Yeah. That's what I mean.
Looks like a product of harmonic
oscillators. I mean, this is a harmonic oscillator.
No, there you have a non-local term, but here it's just the product over space.
Yeah, yeah.
Harmonic
oscillator. Yeah. So, let's see, remind me, M is E squared times the cancel. So in exponentials, actually 1 over e to the 4.
This is it.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Correct. There is 1 over e to the 4th here. So it looks like... For dimensional reasons, it should be. Yeah.
Because
and
of the b squared.
That's right. So if you take psi star psi, mm-hmm. it'll be like the 2D Yang-Mills action, but with a coupling which is precisely given by these factors involving e squared and so on. So then we can go and calculate the Wilson law. Mm-hmm. And that's easy to calculate because this is effectively the 2D Yang-Mills action. So we can calculate and we find an area law. Okay? So that has been done by many, many people at this point. We can.
So this is the Wilson law for large contours.
That's right. Asymptotically
assuming,
for.
Or actually, all of this is really assuming you can use that for okay.
That's correct.
You know, really not.
I don't know how to do it exactly.
Yeah.
That's correct. But if I can use the low momentum limit, then this is the answer. So, for asymptotically large Wilson lines, I expect this might be the exact answer. That's the statement. I'm sorry?
Smooth.
I didn't hear what it
is. Smooth.
Yes. Yes. That's right. For the string tension, we get this number just from the putting these factors here. And this is the formula that I showed you in the beginning. And it is, as I said, consistent with large N. Okay. Even though we have not used large N at this point. I also want to show you the numbers involved. This is a lattice calculation by Michael Tepper, who has done it for SU2, 3, 4, and 5. And these blue numbers are our numbers from here. And you can actually see that they are quite close, actually.
How big are the error bars?
Its maximum error bar is 3%. I mean, sorry, difference is 3%. Tepper's error bars, if you actually take what he quotes, are smaller than that. So you can ask, is there a genuine difference? I'm not exactly sure, because I cannot myself estimate what the finite size effects are in his calculation. I believe Tepper is coming here. Unfortunately, I will miss his stay here, but he might have an answer to that. So I cannot quite say whether this is a genuine discrepancy or something I should worry about.
Well, that makes him extrapolate the infinite bodies, right?
He does. He does.
Make some statement about the errors.
He has errors quoted, which are smaller. I don't remember them offhand, but they are smaller than this. So if you take his numbers for what they are, accept them, then there is a genuine discrepancy. Mm-hmm. But not being much of a lattice expert, I can't quite.
The hardest thing is that this is an exponentially falling object as you
right.
make the area larger.
That's correct.
And so you're trying to dig out a very small signal.
That's right.
And sophisticated methods by Lucia, maybe it's all wrong now, let's try to do that better.
Could be. I don't know. I mean, for me, it is very hard to judge. I should also point out that for larger n, the agreement becomes better, actually. for whatever reason.
So if you believe this is an exact result?
Asymptotically for large Wilson lines, I think.
Yeah, well, that's the definition.
That's the definition of string tension.
And have you tried to use the there are other terms, right.
Yes. And there are cubic terms and so on.
Right.
Also higher powers of momentum.
Well, you see, higher powers of momentum we could ignore, but the cubic terms and...
Yeah, I think the basic question, I think, is the following, that, you see, the quadratic term, let me phrase it here. Let's start with this one, starting with psi naught equal to 1. Now we are going to add the potential energy and correct psi. The first correction is the quadratic term, b squared. So this is the first term in a 1 over e squared expansion. Now you can ask, what happens if I add contributions from other terms? At low momentum, I can do a 1 over e squared expansion. And then if I calculate corrections to sigma, I should get whatever it is, but the expansion parameter is a momentum over e squared. Therefore, asymptotically, it has to vanish. And that is effectively what seems to happen. So I can look at the cubic term, its contribution seems to go like. Because the cubic term is one higher power in 1 over e squared, its contribution seems to go like this. This is the statement. That is why I believe it would be an exact result. Because I don't know how else, how, what other kind of correction could we get? Since there is only one dimensional parameter, e squared, and we are expanding in 1 over e squared, it has to be a momentum upstairs. And that momentum goes to zero. Therefore, corrections presumably vanish. So there is, I think, just one quantity like this which might be exact. Many other things we can say. I'm running a bit over time. Is that okay? Let me just go back to the magnetic mass. Now that we have obtained some statement about the string tension, I can ask, can I go back to the question of the magnetic mass in the theory? The kinetic term had this structure where m was this parameter. Therefore, if I simply look at the kinetic term, a single power of j is an eigenstate with eigenvalue m. Of course, a single power of j is not useful, but nevertheless, we know that if you are going to do perturbation theory, we are going to use perturbative gluons. It is that single power of j that we are using as a gluon. So in comparing this calculation with what is done in perturbation theory, it would be justified to consider this j as a basic variable and try to see what the Hamiltonian looks like for that case. Okay. I also point out that if you put the potential term, not surprisingly, this becomes square root of k squared plus m squared. It's not an exact eigenstate. There are further corrections here. Okay. So what do? We take the Wiseminer term from the measure, absorb it into the definition of the wave function, which means I had to redefine my Hamiltonian, and then do a perturbative expansion. Because the purpose here is to simply try to recapture perturbation theory from this point of view. Okay? And if I do that, the Hamiltonian simply looks like this. There is a mass square term. This phi field looks like a massive field. Okay? So this is a field that you would see if you do perturbation theory starting from this formulation. Of course, it's not quite perturbation theory. Why? Because m goes like e squared. So if it is perturbation theory, this is a perturbative correction. You would expand in powers of m. So this looks more like a partially resummed perturbation theory. And this resummation should presumably produce some sort of a mass for this. So this would act as a gluon mass in perturbation theory in some partial resum version. What is the mass parameter we find for this? And it would be this one, which for SU2 is this number here. I want to emphasize the fact that, you see, when we say magnetic mass, it is not perturbatively defined, but its use is within perturbation theory, thermal perturbation theory. You want to incorporate that into the theory. And therefore, this going back to perturbation theory is justified for that purpose. Okay. So I look at this mass term. The number is 0.32 to remember. What are the lattice calculations? These are the numbers. It is a very difficult quantity to calculate in the lattice, because what happens is that people have to do a lattice gauge fixing to calculate it. And then the numbers, this was extracted by Philipson from a common factor for glue ball masses, which are computed on the lattice. These are direct calculations on the lattice in different gauges. This is from resummation of perturbation theory. And this last result probably is the best lattice result. This was giving a gauge invariant lattice definition of what this quantity means and then trying to calculate it numerically. So that is the value you get. So 0.32 is our value to be compared to 0.37. That is what we get. It's not quite clear, but I mean, as I said, this is a very difficult quantity to get a handle on. I mean, these numbers, for example, also are gauge dependent. So I don't think there is a definitive answer yet. So I don't want to say very much about that. But okay, let me come back to the issue of glue balls. As I mentioned, single J is an eigenstate of the kinetic term, but it's not a good state because we don't have this holomorphic invariance that I mentioned. Okay. However, since J transforms in this fashion, if I take a D bar and V is holomorphic, D bar J transforms covariantly, and therefore I can construct objects which are invariant starting from this. Let me look at what might look like a 0++ type glue ball. You would expect something that looks like this, a D bar J, another D bar J. If I separate the two points, then of course I have to put, because of this holomorphicity factors here, I have to put something that takes the V from here to the V here. Okay? So this is an analog of a Wilson line, but it's a purely holomorphic Wilson line, so to speak. So this is the quantity I need, and F is some arbitrary function depending on two points. If I take it to be my regulated delta function, then T acting on this is 2m. That is the result I mentioned earlier, that T acting on the potential energy is going to give me 2m times V. You can ask whether this can be done for other combinations. The answer is yes, you can make combinations like this with factors in between. You can put an invariant tensor and take it at the same point by taking this regulated delta function to take the operator product at the same point. You can show that the mass goes like this if there are n such factors. You can include, so it looks like, you know, at the level of the kinetic term, there is some massive object that you can generate. By the way, these operators are all orthogonal to the ground state, so they are really excited states in the theory. You can include center of mass motion. That is easy. But when you include relative motion, I cannot contract them all to be there at the same point. I got to point separate them, and then it becomes very complicated. Okay. But presumably, that would give some sort of wedge trajectory. Going back to psi 2, we actually did that, point separated it and found an equation for F. It looks like this. Okay. Now, this equation I have to warn you is approximate in many ways. There are, the psi 2 that I gave is not an exact eigenstate. Therefore, it generates new operator structures when the Hamiltonian acts on it. So I have to take some limit where those structures are negligible, which is a small x minus y separation limit. That's where you find the Coulomb potential here, the two-dimensional, 2 plus 1 Coulomb potential. So the statement is that if I could solve this equation, then for every eigenvalue E, I should be able to go back and construct the operator psi 2 as a blue ball corresponding to that state. However, notice that everything here is effectively controlled by the parameter M, and therefore there is an issue of consistency which we have not been able to resolve. Namely, you have a wave function which spreads out. You have to ask what is the width of the wave function at the momentum scale associated with that. Is this approximation justified? And that is kind of borderline because it's the same mass parameter which controls both. Okay. So we don't have a clear statement on blue ball masses from here, but that is something we think about. That's right. Yeah, we choose this in such a way that this is orthogonal to the ground state function. That's what we do.
So that's what the tendency solve this equation.
Yeah, what we do is we want this to be orthogonal to the ground state,
yeah,
and we want this Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation is not satisfied because the Hamiltonian generates new operator structures. So we also assume that those structures are negligible, which is for short distance, short separations, and then we get this equation. So if we can consistently solve this, I mean, with an a posteriori consistency of the small distance approximation, we could say something. But it's not entirely clear. Is that?
No, but the strategy would be to give an E, solve this for F,
yes,
and use the orthogonality to determine the eigenvalues.
Right.
Is it the orthogonality or the normalizability? And you have normalizable solutions for any energy?
Normalizability and orthogonality, we have to use both.
So which one is crucial for this weakness?
Well, what we have done is we ensured that initially this operator structure is orthogonal to the ground state. So, well, there will be a continuum for the center of mass motion.
The lowest eigenvalue.
That's right. That's what we expect. Yeah. Well, the thing is, I mean, this is like.
Just assume that it works and it's okay, the approximation.
Here, there is a center of mass motion, which is a continuum. Right? This is like a two body Schrödinger equation. We factor that out. For the remainder, there will be a discrete set of eigenvalues, because it's like a confining potential.
But here, M is a parameter. Can you take M more?
Yeah, M is a fixed number. It is.
Oh, it's a scale.
M is a scale. But
after all, I mean, aside from approximation, it's supposed to be exact. Blue balls decay on the beam.
That's right.
So where is that?
It is in the fact that this, to get this equation, we have neglected terms with a different operator structure generated by the Hamiltonian. Those can, yeah, because they are mixing with higher number of J's and so on, so clearly they are mixing with other blue ball states. So they could presumably lead to the decay. It could happen that the lowest state I obtain from here, this low 0++, is stable, but the other ones, as I go to higher and higher eigen energy values, then the approximation of neglecting those higher terms become worse and worse, and they would have to be included, leading to decay. This is what I would expect would happen.
Does Lager simplify anything here? Or?
So far, we don't see any. In fact, that was a big puzzle, and I was hoping that Largen would simplify things at that point. But so far, we have not been able to see that, actually. I'm sorry? So far, we don't see how Largen simplifies. It would be very nice if that's the way we could handle those terms, and we have not succeeded in doing that.
We have some numerics solutions to these?
No, we haven't really worked out the numerics on this. Because there is only one control parameter, we feel that all the, barring numerical accidents.
You know, the second one is less than twice the first one, then there's a chance for a couple of them.
Possibly, yeah. We haven't really done. Yeah, because that's what I was saying, that we have to assume. So let me put it this way. We act with a Hamiltonian on this soil 2, which contains this F function. So this gives me something proportional to soil 2, plus something, let's say, that involves soil 3, soil 4, and so on, which have more J's, J cubed, J4, and so on. But these terms can be neglected if I assume that the separation, average separation I started with here, is small. Okay, so less than, say, 1 over n. Then I can neglect them and get an eigenvalue state. But of course, when I do that, I'm already in the short distance limit, and I get a Coulomb potential. That's what happens. And that, so to be consistent, then I should be able to find an eigenstate such that the spread of this wave function and the associated momentum for that distance is still large compared to m, so that the approximation is.
Confusing me is that you made a quadratic approximation before to get an area law, a constant tangent.
Yes. Here I'm doing more. Here I'm looking at an excited state, right?
This equation looks completely perturbative, right?
This equation looks perturbative, except for this 2m, though. That's a mass. So that is non-perturbative.
But psi is taken to be
just the potential.
The potential is perturbative.
Psi 2 is just quadratic invariant?
Yes. But of course, eventually.
Whereas psi naught was an exponential.
Exponential of a quadratic, right.
So why not put in psi 2 in Gaussian?
Yeah. Let me put it this way. I wrote psi 2 to be quadratic in J, but this is multiplied by psi naught. That is the state. So I'm just showing you the operator that acts on the vacuum to create the state.
What's bothering me is that you know, with your simple ansatz for psi naught, you argued for a linear potential.
Yes.
Now you're taking as simple an ansatz for psi 2, your derivative potential.
You see, there was an advantage in this case because. You see, here.
The psi naught part of psi 2 should already contain, according to you, the physics that gives a constant string tension.
Part of psi naught should, yes.
So it should give linear confining force.
But.
As large distances, but this is anyway just a short distance
but
approximation.
No, it's
not, so it's not, so it's you could also do a large distance approximation of this, and that would be a linear force.
This part presumably gives a linear potential, as it should, I guess.
Why don't I see it?
The problem is just algebraic complexity. We simply can't simplify to a point that we can see that, actually. We can, however, at high momentum or short distance, we can do that. See, it is possible that some of the higher structures we see should eventually lead to the linear potential, but we don't see that.
Is it possible that if you looked at highly excited states where you should be seeing linear potential, that there would be some simplification instead of lower states? Because that's where you'd be seeing.
But then you would be looking at more J's, so to speak.
Right.
Then it becomes much more complicated to solve. See, what we can say with some degree of exactness is that if I ignore the potential energy completely, then I can get this equation. But this is for all these operators at the same point. That we can do. But once you put in the potential energy, that brings in the relative motion of these things. In fact, the picture is very much like every operator d bar j, roughly speaking, represents a massive particle. And if they're all sitting very close to each other, then it's an exact eigenstate of the kinetic term. The potential energy is what gives you a relative motion for these things. And as you put in the potential energy, they start moving, and then you see the Coulomb potential or linear potential and so on. Starting from this, I have to be then able to take this series. You see, what happened in the ground state was I could start with sine naught equal to 1, I could put in the potential energy perturbatively, I could sum up that series. Here, if I do that, I can do one order or two, but I cannot sum up the series for this the perturbation to this state. That is where the difficulty is. You're not very happy about that. Maybe we can talk about it. I mean, we are stuck on this, actually, because you know, if there is some way to see how to simplify that, that would be very nice. And also, I mean, it's also surprising to us that Largent hasn't shown us how to simplify that also. So that is another issue. I mean, that is precisely where the issue of blue ball decay you would see could be handled. Finally, I'm sorry I ran over time, but this is my last transparency. I just want to talk about Yang-Mills Chern-Simons for a second. I had a Chern-Simons term. A lot of the things that I said can be repeated. Here is the wave function. Unlike in the pure Yang-Mills case, there is now some kind of an oscillatory prefactor, which should be there because it's a Chern-Simons term. It can't be a pure positive definite term kind of wave function. The measure can be calculated. Notice that now I really have k plus 2 Ca, the level k coming from Chern-Simons. Kinetic term, things get modified for this part, not for this part. The ground state, again, the quadratic part I have displayed here can be calculated. But what is the interest in all that? The interest is that if I look at now the Wilson line, you find screening rather than area law. Now that is as expected. But you can ask, what is the reason within our formulation? And the reason is that if I go back and look at this this term here as a conformal field theory, now I have more integrable operators because k is no longer zero. I have something more than the identity. And those operators can precisely screen the Wilson line. Okay? In fact, they look like actually fermions in two dimensions, the first set of operators. And the screening of kind of Wilson line in 2D Yang-Mills with fermions has been studied by many people, by David Gross and Igor and Sonnenschein and so on. So there's a lot of work on that. We can just show exactly how that fits in and you get screening. So it's kind of a nice thing to do in that sense. Large K, of course, we reproduce standard perturbation theory. And so that's kind of a test of some of these concepts that I mentioned earlier.
Okay. You get no operators.
Yes.
But the wave function is similar.
The wave function is similar, except this parameter has changed. There is also this factor here that's crucial. There's an extra. Okay. That's coming from the Chern-Simons. That's also crucial.
So if I now look at this wave function for a small momentum components to this wave function, it changes dramatically?
It changes. It changes to the extent that you find. You see, what happens, let me go back here, actually. It's not so much from here. What happens is that d mu h with this 2 Ca is exactly the gauge invariant measure that we calculate. The k part is as if I have an extra set of fermions. I mean, I can think of it as if coming from the determinant of fermions. Those fermions are really the new operators that we have. So when I do calculations with this measure, I'll be doing effectively Yang-Mills theory with a bunch of fermions, which will screen the loop. I'm sorry?
They would be in the fundamental representation.
Yeah. And they would screen the loop exactly as in two dimensions. That's the way it works, actually. So I think I'll stop since I ran over time and so on.